What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. John Krofcik with Larry Rifkin on a tough topic on this episode. And we've had a lot of tough topics lately, John.
Boy, you are not kidding.
But we don't walk away from them. We really don't.
We're tough.
We are tough. And, you know, in a recent interview we were doing, a guest told us that FDR had a great line, John, about the direction of history. If you look at the arrow, it's always pointed upward. And that gives us a lot of hope and promise that as much as we complain and bemoan what's going on today, today's a whole lot better than yesterday. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that, yeah. You know, I look at some of the things that went on in the past, and in a lot of ways, I think we're a lot better off. I do.
Except for the fact that we do have now a president who I want to take this opportunity to quote Wilhelm II, I believe it was, who said he wanted to be the bride at every wedding and the corpse at every funeral. And that pretty much defines what we're following in the news these days. We can't get our minds off of the immediacy of this presidency because it's so omnipresent. Wherever you go, there he is.
You're absolutely right.
And that's the way he likes it. So, but if we can get by all of that, what we are told is that things really on the main are getting a whole lot better. And we'll discuss that in another podcast. But today, I'm looking at this topic and I'm saying, I know that's true. And I know that these folks that we're going to be addressing today are marginalized to some degree in our society, but why are they still here? And you and I, John, we're talking today about white supremacists. We're talking about the KKK, the skinheads, and all of these outlier groups. Why do we still have them in America?
Here again, you know, I don't get it. I just don't get it. But you know what? You look at the internet and you know, you can take these small things and you put them on the internet and, you know, people seem to believe, some people just seem to believe anything that they read.
When you think about it, John, you know what it is? I think we're so polarized today in America and we've gone to such extremes that fake news is something that's been co-opted. The left says it about the right says it about the left. And when you have nobody who really is the fount of integrity, we think they're both really at times way out of line, then who do we trust? And so you can throw that word around, and that's why someone like Donald Trump of questionable ethic can operate in this environment, because where is the moral authority? Because he's chastising the Justice Department and they're chastising him. And we're all sitting here saying, who do I believe? And should I believe anyone at this point?
Well, that's my problem these days. It's hard to know what to believe anymore because you don't know who's spinning it and what the truth really is. I mean, I agree with you there with fake news. We've really got to somehow get a grip on this and get some integrity back into
news. Now it's been co-opted by everyone. And when you look at citizen journalists without proper branding, they can say anything they want and get it out over the internet. I heard someone the other night say, it's not that a lie can travel around the world in 5 to 10 times the truth. It's that really before truth can get his pajamas on, it's gone to the moon and back. I mean, that's how quickly stuff spreads today. It's pretty remarkable. But there is a story that just won't go away, and that is about these groups, some of these radical groups. And when you think about it, John, we have shed much of our ugly past from, you know, the old days of the Civil War and the Civil Rights Act, finally, and then our first black president. But we still have these individuals on the fringe who just won't give up their vision of an America that doesn't include a whole lot of us.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, it is scary, and it's scary that they still exist. I mean, What are we going
to
do?
Well, when we go back to Charlottesville last year and we saw that bigotry and hatred, and I was very concerned when I saw that, certainly concerned about what the president had to say about it. But we are told during this particular podcast, and I'm not going to necessarily say exactly what Vegas Tenol told us, but he did indicate that Charlottesville was a turning point as it relates to these white supremacist groups. And what we have to understand is, they were looking at this moment as being a defining moment in their rebirth. That's what they were hoping for.
Yeah, I don't think it worked out so well. But you know what concerns me about all this is we're also trying to erase history on top of it, because we're saying, and maybe they were, but I mean, you can't take all the bad stuff that people have done in the past and say, well, he's bad because of the take away from the good stuff they've done. So we're also trying to erase history, which it kind of scares me a little bit.
Well, I do think that a lot of this monument replacement, it should go into museums. It should be there for us to understand, just as we don't want to forget about the Holocaust. And we want to make certain that everybody remembers this. And I'm really stunned, John, and you may have seen this, where millennials, there are, I think, 40% of the millennials know nothing about the Holocaust. They're just not being taught, and therefore they've forgotten how calamitous, how barbaric this period was in modern Europe. It's remarkable. We can't forget that.
Well, I mean, it's not only that, though. I mean, that's only one small part. They're not even aware that what socialism, what communism is. They look at it as being good because they don't understand, you know, the people who originally fled here from them. My grandparents, and I'm sure your grandparents, they don't understand what that really means. So, I mean, we got a whole problem with the future because we haven't taught history properly in the classroom.
And now on the internet, I mean, what goes for history or presumes to be history may not be that at all. And a lot of young people are really influenced by that. And that's one of the reasons that some of these far right, you know, white supremacist groups have been able to reemerge in their minds. Primarily in their minds, because they did it on the internet and they did it under the cloak of anonymity. But when they ended up stepping onto the streets of Charlottesville, well, that's a whole different matter. And we get into that in this conversation with Vegas Tenold. Now, you may wonder who he is. He's a gentleman who's a great journalist. And what he did for us, John, was an incredible public service. He went into a situation with all of these fringe groups to get to know them, to understand them, and to really try to help us understand whether, in fact, this is just an annoyance or a real threat going forward in the 21st century. And what's really interesting, John, you may wonder, how did he come up with a title for this book, Everything You Love Will Burn? Now,
you're talking about a depressing title.
I know. Well, it was election night 2016, and there was a guy that he followed with great interest and intensity, Matthew Heimbach. And Matthew Heimbach was called, now I hate to even use this term, but he was called the Little Fuhrer. I mean, that was the title, and he was going to rally all of these groups into one amalgam. That was his goal. And to some extent, Vegas felt that he was going to likely be the one in America, if anyone was going to do it, that would bring these disparate groups together. Because not only do they have concerns in their own minds about America, but they have prejudices against each other. So they don't agree on much of anything, thank goodness.
Which is a good thing. Yeah.
But we are going to reveal in the course of this conversation why he named the book what he named it, Everything You Love Will Burn. And then I'm going to do a bit of a postscript. So this was after we recorded this interview with Vegas. Something happened to Matt Heimbach that I think you'll want to know, having heard this podcast. And, well, stay tuned for that after we talk to Vegas Tenold. With us on the line is Vegas Tenold, and he's written a book called Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of the White Nationalism in America. Is there really a rebirth?
That is a very good question, because a lot of people would say that it is an incarnation of the same old far-right nationalism you've seen throughout recent history. So, you know, in some ways it is, because it's a very new animal we're talking about that's been helped along by the internet. But, you know, at the base of it all, the foundation is the same kind of tired old tropes too. You know, the Jews are secretly controlling everything, and the white man is in trouble. So it is and it isn't, is what I would say.
And some of the groups that you embedded with and that you really went down deep to find out who they were today and what they're really about, I mean, we don't even recognize some of the names. Give us some of the names of the groups that you were following.
Well, I mean, it is a chaotic place, the far right, obviously. And groups come and go kind of like toadstools. And you know, particularly in the KKK scene, there are a lot of groups who pop up and then go away again. But the groups I kind of focused on for this was the traditionalist Workers' Party. I'm sorry, led by a guy called Matthew Heimbach, they've turned into a national socialist fascist organization, but they used to be kind of more nativist, alt-right. There's a lot of isms in this as well, obviously. There's a lot of things that make little difference, but they put very much weight too. And also I chose the National Socialist Movement, which is the largest national socialist organization in America. They're the typical neo-Nazis. They're very fond of Hitler. They march in uniforms and that kind of thing. And then I chose a guy who at that time was the leader of something called the Nordic Order Knights, which is a Klan group, and that went defunct, and he switched over to the Virgil Griffin White Knights, and then that went away. And so the Klan is very difficult to sort of keep track of what groups are with who and who's in and who's out. But those are kind of the main three factions of far-right nationalism that I chose to go with.
And how do they look at each other? And do they really want to come together? I know that in the book you talk a lot about Charlottesville and the implications of what happened at Charlottesville as to whether they were coming together and what that event did, and we do want to explore that. But what is the notion of them coming together under one rubric? Is that possible?
I think it's by necessity. They all realize that they don't have much manpower on their own. So I think they're coming together out of a shared necessity. And you know, my first Klan rally, which was back in 2011, I believe, some skinheads showed up, some neo-Nazis showed up, and the Klan was at that time mortified, because they were, you know, we don't see eye to eye with the neo-Nazis on certain things. But I see people put aside a lot of squabbles and ideological differences to kind of come together. Now, whether or not that has worked is a whole different matter. The relative sense of unity that might have existed in the 12 minutes before Charlottesville kicked off certainly has gone away by now. But I think they're kind of, yeah, they're reluctantly coming together.
And you said that they always retreat back to these tropes about the Jews controlling the world, this, that, and the other. I mean, when they do have a debate, if they do, about the various isms, I mean, how do you listen to that as a journalist? I mean, are any of them really making cogent sense of anything? Or when you listen to it, how do you even respond, or how do you internalize what it is they're trying to project?
That's a difficult one. I mean, the isms become, to us who as outsiders, they become kind of meaningless. You know, when Richard Spencer says that he isn't a nationalist, he is an identitarian because he identifies as a white man, that becomes, you know, fairly meaningless to anyone but him. And also, a lot of these things are kind of dog whistling terms. They're used to mask the true, you know, what their ideology is. If someone says, "I'm not a racist, I'm racially aware," that means the same thing, but to them, they're kind of trying to, I don't know, make their spiel a little bit more palatable. Within the groups, there's very little discussion sort of across group lines of, you know, you believe this and I believe that. There's more just bickering and infighting. You know, you're wrong, you got this all wrong, and this isn't the way to do it. But for me, it was extremely helpful that I was always very open about my own political beliefs. I'm a Norwegian. I voted socialist all my life, because you can still do that in Norway and it makes a difference. And I always told them that, you know, basically as you see it, I'm your political enemy, but I used it to be able to argue with them, to be able to sort of to fight back. And to me, that was an important, you know, safety valve almost. It was like a release. If I had to sit there and be neutral and just take it, I think my head would have exploded. But
yet you thought you might have been used by Mr. Heimbach because he tried to temper things and sound more moderate. And then as he got into the heat of battle, if you will, he began to show some elements of his extreme views that you hadn't seen at a certain point.
Yeah, I mean, I think Matthew has changed over the years as well. And I think when I first met him, obviously he did have some very strong and quite frankly abhorrent views on Jews and immigration and all those kinds of things. But I think he honestly wanted to grow the pie with people from outside. He at some point, I do think he believed that he could go outside of the far right scene in America and gain members. As I spent time with him, I saw him, you know, react to the challenges of that, and I think he made a conscious choice about, you know, it's easier to just recruit from within the movement. He wanted to be a leader of men, and for him it was easier to find those men where they already agreed with him than going outside. And I do think that hardened him, because he didn't really have a need anymore to sound as
moderate or reasonable.
There was no need to sound moderate, and also there was nothing to be gained to sound moderate. You know, if you're a moderate in the far right scene and you want to recruit within the far right scene, there's really only one way to go. And you know, he chose to go far further right. And perhaps I should have seen it, because even from before I'd met him, he'd always been on a rightward trajectory. When I met him, he just kind of kept going.
It sounds almost like the primary system that we have here in America these days, in terms of people talking amongst the choir. What is the difference between white nationalism and a white supremacist? And do they differentiate?
I think there is a small difference. Now, whether or not the characters in my book can be said, some of them claim to not be white supremacists, and whether or not you believe them or not is, you know, sometimes I don't even know. But, you know, nationalism at its core is the sense that a nation's best interest is served, you know, via protectionist policies and that kind of thing, and strong borders. Whereas a white supremacist, it really isn't a political view at all. It's just that the white race is inherently better than other races. Now, these two things overlap a whole lot. You know, white nationalists will oftentimes be white supremacists as well. So that's kind of the difference. One is a political point of view, I think, and one is just an idea of race.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well,
not
you can
us,
direct
though. We
message
have
us
real news.
At Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two, and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
they can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
And you began reporting on these various malcontents way back in 2011, and you say that the Tea Party was perhaps a vanguard of some of this frustration. Then, of course, it carries over into the 2016 election. Put this into some historical context, looking back.
Well, I think you're right when you call them malcontents, and I think that what grew the Tea Party was this frustration in the status quo and in the establishment. And I think that anger also fed the far right going into 2016. And, you know, I think that's also that explains a lot of the problems I've had since, because it is an antagonistic point of view. It's an antagonistic way of seeing the world. You're against the system. You're against the status quo. And, you know, you might argue that they kind of won when Trump became president, and that gives them, you know, that puts them in a relative sense of power, and they're having a lot of trouble now to figure out for themselves what now. Like, we're no longer in opposition, quote unquote. We have to come up with something. But, you know, I think most of these nationalist populist movements throughout history have been driven by a deep-seated sense of frustration with society.
And did they believe in early 2017, after the 2016 election, that this was their moment, because there were so many working white people who may never think of joining any of these extremist groups, and yet they were venting their grievances through the political system, and that this gave them this great opening to bring on some of the people from the outside? And Mr. Heimbach perhaps had the right idea about trying to take those concerns and bring them just a little further out to the far, hard alt-right.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of these guys saw this before the rest of us. I remember a chat I was having with Jeff Scoop, the leader of the NSM, in 2011, the first time I ever met him. And he said, you know, he was talking about at some point running candidates for election and getting nationalist politicians elected. And, you know, I thought he'd been huffing glue. And he said, well, no, I think the Americans are ready to hear our message. We just need the right person. And again, I thought he was crazy, but fast forward 5 or 6 years, it turns out he was right. And it turns out Americans are ready to hear a nativist, populist, nationalist message if it's packaged the right way. And, you know, I do think, although a lot of people on the far right were and still are very enthusiastic about Donald Trump, most of them, I think, realizes that he's not the nationalist candidate they're looking for, but he's very much a foot in the door. He's the first of what they hope will be many nationalist leaders.
But do any of them believe, Matthew Heimbach or Richard Spencer or any of them, that they can take off some of the very dramatically extreme clothing that they've been wearing and the pageantry of all of this and really become that kind of leader for all Americans or potentially many Americans?
I think they did. I don't think they do that much anymore. After Charlottesville, I was having a conversation with Matthew Heimbach, sort of like a where do we go from here conversation, and he just basically said, well, you know, we've tried politics now. We've tried to give rallies and to give speeches, and, you know, to him it was clear that he wouldn't be allowed to speak, whether or not that was from, you know, colleges banning him or Antifa pelting him with rocks. He felt certain at that point that, you know, talking wouldn't help anymore, and if you wanted to be a nationalist from then on, you had to be ready to fight in the street. I don't necessarily think that Spencer agrees with that, but I do think that 2017 saw a hardening of the far right, and they have a much more warlike mentality right now than they had. I think they thought that politics was a relatively easy avenue after Trump, but I think now with you know, with Antifa and this very strong popular opinion against them, I think they've kind of gotten, they've got a taste of reality.
You, of course, point to Heather Heyer's murder at Charlottesville as really changing the direction of the white nationalist movement. And yet many of us were focused on Donald Trump giving a certain moral equivalence to both sides. So many of us saw this as perhaps a moment politically where the president of the United States might have given more validity to these groups than we could ever have imagined.
Yeah, I think that's true, and it's just another example of Trump being extremely craven and catering to what is an increasingly extremist base. But as for the far right, that intense scrutiny and public pressure after Charlottesville just became too much, and it broke them apart. Some of the groups that attended Charlottesville were relatively new groups on the scene, American Vanguard and Identity Europa. And American Vanguard, I believe, almost folded because they weren't prepared for that. Now, Matthew and the NSM and, to a certain degree, Richard Spencer have been doing this for a long time, and they know the social cost of being an out-and-out national socialist or nationalist. So they were kind of prepared for it. But the movement as a whole, you know, if 2017 was their coming out party, then Charlottesville was the first real challenge and kind of showed them what this meant. And that's why a lot of members of these new groups left the movement after Charlottesville. They just saw that this isn't make-believe. You know, a person is dead. This is the real deal. It's not just us playing war games anymore.
Well, you pointed out that a lot more people among these groups get injured after drinking too much beer out in the fields one day amongst themselves. So are we to look at them as still being laughing stocks?
I think yes and no. I mean, they are clearly able to cause significant damage and injury. We have, you know, a marked increase in hate groups. An SPLC report just came out yesterday, 2017's year in hate, that showed a marked increase in hate groups. There's been a decline in skinhead groups, but, you know, the quote unquote alt right groups have had a pretty good year. There's been, you know, several murders linked to members of alt-right groups. So I think it's absolutely clear that they present a danger. And then, you know, what's more, a lot of the rhetoric that's now made its way into the Oval Office even and Congress has its roots in the far right. So even though they haven't become the ideological kitchen that Richard Spencer thought they would become in the beginning of 2017, they certainly have an impact. And this year, I think we're going to see them try to get into colleges more. I think we're going to see them do a very concerted push to recruit at colleges, and I think that's dangerous.
Why would they be welcomed into colleges? I know we've had a lot of disputes on campus about the First Amendment and allowing people whose views may not be popular to speak. Where's the opening in the college scene here in America for them?
I think they've been able to construct a narrative that conservative voices at colleges are not only frowned upon, but persecuted. You know, I don't believe that's true, but I think they've been able to make that case to their members and to certain elements at colleges. And I think they realize that, you know, there's no real downside to announcing these big speeches or big college pushes. And you know, the song and dance is always the same. The college tries to ban them from speaking, and then they sue, and then they win the lawsuit, and then they speak anyway, and then they get to claim that, you know, they're victims and their First Amendment
rights. Taking the moral high ground, yes.
Exactly, and to a certain degree, I'm not saying that we let them, but, you know, they've realized that there is no downside for them to do this. So I think they're quite enjoying it. I think Spencer is having fun. You know, kind of, it's almost like he's trolling us again.
Explain a little bit about Richard Spencer and his importance to trying to unite this movement.
Well, Richard Spencer is, you know, I don't know, I don't claim to know him that well. He's not the person I spent the most time with, but I've spent a fair amount of time with Richard Spencer. And, you know, it's been said by many to me that, you know, the big galvanizing moment of the far right wasn't the election or the inauguration of Donald Trump. It was the moment Richard Spencer got punched. And I think that was hugely important in his career, because up until then he was seen by, you know, large parts of the movement as a dandy. You know, Matthew Heimbach on several occasions called him a tea or martini sipping a-hole. And he was kind of he called himself the intellectual lodestar of the far right, and he was happy to come up with his little blog posts and write his essays. But when he got punched, he gained the respect of the boots in the movement. You know, he shed blood for the cause almost, and it allowed him to reinvent himself as a leader, as someone who had fought, as someone who, you know, looked the enemy in the eye almost. And so I think to him it was the best thing that could have happened to him. And you know, look at him now. He goes to rallies. He rolls up the sleeves of his shirt. He gets arrested. He's at the front lines. So I think that was a hugely important moment for the far right movement.
Vegas Tenhold is with us. Everything You Love Will Burn is the book. And that title, give us the genesis for it.
Yeah, so the title was, it was on election night in 2017, and I was in Paoli, Indiana, where Matthew lives. And I was watching the election with him and some of his guys. And, you know, for most of the day, people just assumed that Hillary was going to win, and I was sitting in the living room in his trailer. We were drinking beer, and I was kind of watching it all come together. And that needle that the New York Times had was still on, you know, 95% sure that Hillary was going to win, and everything was great. And you know, around 8 o'clock or maybe a bit earlier, things started going wrong. Well, that depends on how you look at it, by the way, but. I certainly wasn't happy. And then when it got to be around 11 o'clock, it was pretty clear that Trump had won this, and we were out of beer. I drank all the beer, and Wisconsin still hadn't been called. So, you know, there was technically a chance that Hillary might not lose, but I'd left the journalist in me behind, and I was just kind of upset about the whole thing. So I stole Matthew Heimbach's car. Well, I just grabbed the keys and I drove back to the hotel. And I remember there were TV screens on in the lobby, and I just kind of walked past them, averting my eyes. And at that moment, kind of Hillary was like a Schrodinger's president, like she was and she wasn't. And if I never knew what she was, then she could be president. So I just went to bed. And then at 3 a.m., I woke up to a text from Matthew, and it said, Wisconsin goes to Trump. Everything you love will burn, LOL. And I just went back to bed, and the next morning I read that message again. I thought, well, okay, this isn't the best news, but I guess I can use this.
We did a podcast on the New South, and we were talking about the internet and the importance of the internet as it relates to groups who now can really fashion their own virtual network of followers without exposing who they are. The anonymity has given them something very special to recreate some of these movements of the past. But you say that born in the catacombs of the internet is destined to crumble when brought into the physical world. Explain that to us.
Well, yeah, I think it's hard to bring a movement that's based on anonymity and trolling into to manifest that into any kind of power. I mean, you know, we say that the alt-right had a huge hand in electing Donald Trump, yet the biggest rally, the one in Charlottesville, was, I don't know, 400 people. So I think that's been a major challenge for them. And you know, I think you describe both the strengths and the weakness of the modern far right. I mean, it's very easy to become a movement, you know, when you can use the internet. But then if you ever have to mobilize that movement into anything short of, you know, a Twitter action, then it becomes very hard. So the internet has been the apotheosis of the far right, but it's also broke it in the sense that the far right used to be this pretty self-policing place that, you know, you couldn't talk, you couldn't badmouth each other because at some point you had to meet. You know, what you did, if you were in the far right, you went to concerts together or you went to rallies. So, and if you'd spend all your time badmouthing people, then you would get a beating. So the internet, the far right now is this very fractious place where, you know, everything goes and everyone can say whatever they want to each other, and there's all these this bickering and all this infighting. So I think the internet absolutely helped it become a movement, but it's also really shown the limitations of what that movement can do.
You remind us that we should not fixate too much on the pageantry of these extremist groups. They do make for great books and documentaries and so forth. But you, as an outsider, you see America as a place where there's always been a lot of racial inequality and division, and perhaps you're holding up a mirror that we all need to look at, that we've got private prisons and mandatory sentencing, unconstrained police power, and that blacks have always had so many disadvantages, and many of the whites today who think they are disadvantaged have no idea what the history of African Americans has been in our society, and there is so much systemic racism that we should focus on to a greater degree than some of these extreme groups.
Yeah, and I mean clearly it's a problem that there is Klan in America and that there are neo-Nazis in America. But they're not at the core of racism in America. And you know, every time you see the every time the Klan does something, or you know, after Charlottesville, there's always this like clamoring that people say, you know, this isn't the America I know, but it's like, well, yes, it is. America is a country that has, throughout their history, has been a white supremacist country that's kind of built on the backs of white supremacy and racism. And I think, you know, yes, we should be rid of all these groups, but I think it would help the country more if we also, you know, looked at how we incarcerate minorities at vastly greater rates than we do whites. If we look at poverty, if we look at, you know, de facto segregation in schools, and you know, that's where the real racism, at least to me, comes in. The Klan isn't going to march 20,000 strong through the streets of D.C. anytime soon, but that doesn't mean we don't have a problem with systemic racism.
How do we guard against this virulent strain becoming much more unconstrained and becoming more popularized by a set of grievances that somehow the white community has adopted, even if, in fact, looking at it historically, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense?
I think we open our eyes and our ears to it. We acknowledge that it is there, that it is a fact, that, you know, we have this, I feel like it's a growing audience of disaffected, angry white men, and you know, to a certain degree women, but also men. And I think we need to hear what they have to say so that we can arm ourselves against their rhetoric. Now, you know, the rhetoric of Richard Spencer, of Matthew Heimbach, isn't great. Like, their points can be torn down, but we need to hear what they have to say so we can say, no, that's actually not true. You know, the white race isn't persecuted. No, the Jews don't run everything. We just need to sort of hear how banal it is. And then we also need to acknowledge that there are parts of America that is desperately poor and desperately, you know, I almost said desperately white. But we need to acknowledge that there are angry people in this country and that we need to try to do something about it.
Well, we have in the White House right now somebody that they call the God Emperor. How do we begin to limit their influence if he's giving such voice to many of their concerns, but also doing it in a way that is dividing America today?
You know what? I have absolutely no idea. You know, because I feel like there's so many factors that are out of control. You know, you're talking about these bots and these networks on the internet that are, you know, run by the Russians and that kind of thing. But I think at the heart of it, we just need to realize that we're all human, and we need to. So a good example. One of the people in my book, the hammer skin called Gabe. I just found out that he's decided to leave the movement, and that he wants to help others leave the movement. And, you know, I was talking to him, and I was saying how great I think that is. And, you know, I think what we should do is we should sort of show these people that, you know, we find their politics completely unacceptable and completely abhorrent, but also that, you know, if you guys want to come back, if you guys want to leave that behind, that's possible. We're not going to shun you. We just, you know, want you to come over to our side.
Vegas Tenold, I can't thank you enough for coming by today. The book is called Everything You Love Will Burn, Inside the Rebirth of White Nationalism in America. And thank you for your insights today on America Trends.
Thank you so much. I'm grateful to be able to be here.
Well, here's the rest of the story about Matthew Heimbach, the so-called new leader of these white nationalists. As we learned, whereas Charlottesville was to be their new awakening, you can now look at it as their Waterloo. It's easy to hide behind your computer screens and robes, but another to be exposed on a bloody Virginia street for the thugs and miscreants you are. And any legitimacy Heimbach might have tried to build as the new leader of the movement in America, practicing his less virulent tone as the, quote, affable, youthful face of hate in America, unquote, came to a most appropriate end in a trailer park of all places. How fitting. You see, he was recently accused of attacking his wife and choking his white nationalist group's co-founder, unconscious, after the pair caught Heimbach having an affair in a trailer with his wife's stepmother, no less. Excuse me while I take out the white trash.